it will make the world a better place for my children if we can work in a part of the world that is currently the least, let's say the talent from that part of the world is least able to access opportunities.
Having an impact and building an organization which enables others to make a difference in the world. Welcome to Inner Podcast. My name is Khalil Bauer, head of Swiss Post's Innovation Lab. My today's guest is Arun Sharma, founder of 10 Academy. 10 Academy recruits high potentials in Africa, train them in 3 months on the hardest industry cases to become machine learning and data engineers, and get a high impact job afterwards. Arun is someone who really drives change and makes a difference. I am certain that you will really love how Arun built 10 Academy and what he learned along the way in this special long Christmas episode. In beginning of 2022, he will share that 10 Academy gets some amazing support from someone we all know. We didn't talk about it much, but from my view, the supporter's decision proves how meaningful 10 Academy will become. Arun studied electrical engineering in Canada, studied at Cambridge. He worked for Accenture and decided then to work for Doctors Without Borders in Darfur during the war. He also worked at Ivory Coast in Afghanistan, South Africa, founded several companies, and founded 10 Academy in 2016. And how this all works, well, Arun will tell you in a second. I personally would like to thank you, each and every one of you, on behalf of the whole Inner Podcast and Swiss Post team, for spending your time with us, for your support and your feedback. We are really thankful for that. Please stay healthy, have a hopefully merry, merry Christmas, and a good start in 2022. We will be back in January. Until then, enjoy the time with Arun. Hi, Arun. Thanks for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here.
First question. I read on your LinkedIn profile that you grew up in Canada. You worked as a consultant for Accenture, and then suddenly and somehow you changed your career path. What happened and why did you do that?
So I was living in Toronto in 2004, and there was the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004. So I was busy at my first full-time job. I was working for Accenture, and I was helping a Canadian natural gas company implement IT systems to improve their efficiency. So I worked a lot and I learned a lot, but I felt like I hadn't done that much to really make my contribution to the world. And so I thought about it, and I actually remember I got my first TV, and I probably started watching a little bit too much TV. And one day I decided, you know what? Today you are going to do something that you've wanted to do and not just kind of do the easy thing and watch TV. So I'd always wanted to do something to make a contribution to the world. And so I thought I would be a little bit picky and a little bit fancy. And I applied to one project, one organization with Doctors Without Borders. And I said, okay, I'm going to do something which sounded really fancy. I imagined kind of jumping out of a helicopter. You know, someone was just about to die, and they got my piece of food, which came out of the helicopter, and I saved their life. In practice, it was much less fancy, much more administrative, probably a lot more useful in the longer run. But I was there in Darfur in Sudan, and I was helping to manage all of the non-technical aspects of a project in a really remote part of the world, very dark physically. There were no lights in the village. We had our own little generators. But for me, it was much more of an experiment and also an experience. And I thought that I would try
it. In an area which is quite some kind of a war area, isn't it?
It's funny. It was. We had someone in our project from London, and he was a nurse, and he said, you know, he felt much safer there than he did in London, because it's true that the whole region was at war, but in practice, we were in a small village, and we were isolated from any of the day-to-day problems that one would face. There were one or two really small situations, but I think my colleague from London summed it up that he felt much safer there than he did in a big city in London, where there were all the small things that you face in a big city. So it's true. It was, in some ways, it was an unstable context. But on the other hand, for me, after the 9 months there, I had taken a leave of absence. And the question was, is this what I really wanted to do? Was it a good use of my time? And for me, the biggest change after the time at Accenture from the basement in Canada was my career path. It wasn't so much about that I changed from Accenture or changed from consulting, but it was a different way to measure how I, it was a different way to measure what I was doing with my time. So my new measure was I using my time in an effective way? Was I making a useful contribution?
What was it before?
That's a good question. I think that it was probably...
Money and working time?
Money and prestige, perhaps. Was I getting... What was my position? What was the view of other people, other colleagues? Salary was probably part of it. I remember specifically the situation. So I had got this job and it was fine. And I ended up, this was in Toronto, they had all these new condominiums that were going up, these apartment buildings. And so I was living right directly on the shore of Lake Ontario in a brand new apartment building. And it looked fancy, glass building. And I remember moving this first apartment I lived in, or not apartment, it was like a hut that the organization had in the middle of Darfur. And I remember thinking, what a change from this glass building on the shore of Lake Ontario to this hut in the middle of Darfur. And it was somehow shocking to see the contrast. But for me, I actually remember one day where our clothes would often get very dirty. And one day I had diesel fuel, breast milk, and dust from construction on my pants. And I was thinking, okay, this is a much more interesting and diverse day than you had sitting in Toronto with your bad khaki pants and ugly shirt. So yeah, I think that measure of how I spent my time changed significantly. And that was the biggest change that I saw. So even if there was this external change around career, when I went to sleep at night, I felt, okay, you've done something useful. And so that was the biggest change for me.
So before we dig deeper in what you're actually doing today with Chan Academy and other parts of it, just in a nutshell, what does Chan Academy do?
So I can say where we want to get to, and we're not 100% of the way there, but our dream is that we have a system that enables any highly motivated young person in Africa to get a high impact job, and that our system enables these young people to do that at scale. So to do that, we need three things, and each of them has to be suitable for high growth in a resource constrained setting. So we need to identify high potential young people. Those high potential young people need the necessary skills that industry is looking for. And that means technical skills, it means career skills, but also it also means the right mindset. And the last part is that they need their first connection into the world of full-time work. So the system that we're aiming to build, and we're part of the way along building that system, is the identification, the upskilling, and then the connection into the world of work. And one of the goals that we have in mind is we want to do this at a rate of around 1 to 2 months of salary. So that if you look at a traditional university education, let's look at an American education, 4-year undergraduate degree, costs in excess of $100,000. That's probably one and a half, maybe even 2 years of salary. And so our goal is to get this down to 1 to 2 months of salary so that you take our program and you can pay the cost of that program within 1 or 2 months.
Probably starting with the first aspect, why focusing on people in Africa and not over the world?
So for me, I think this is part of the journey that I've been on. And I think this is, one, it's rare that you find the right answer right away. So as mentioned, I started off in Sudan, so in the middle of Africa. And after that, I came back and I thought, okay, what can I do? My family's originally from India. Let me see what sort of contribution I can make to my mother country. So I spent a year living and working in India. And I was surprised to see that in India, and I knew quite a bit about India, mostly from family background, but I saw that India was actually relatively well taken care of. Whereas when through the work I'd done in Africa before and the work that I've been doing since, I feel like that's the continent that's currently facing the largest challenge, but it also offers the greatest opportunities. You have billions of people who are there. There are challenges. The one that we're really looking at is youth unemployment. And that, I think, offers the greatest chance to have impact. So that's reason number one. Reason number two, and I often get this question from people that I speak to, are you actually from Africa? Why are you interested? So I think as the father of three children, the world will be a better place for my children if 1/7 of the world's population, today's current African population, and that will continue to increase, if that 1/7 of the world's population is enabled to make a contribution to the rest of the world, A, and B, if some of the most brilliant people from this pool of talent is able to, if we can find those people and to harness their contributions. And so that's my selfish motive. I think that we can, for me as a person, but also me, especially as a father, I think that it will make the world a better place for my children if we can work in a part of the world that is currently the least, let's say the talent from that part of the world is least able to access opportunities.
So what I learned from you the first time we talked and when I looked on your homepage of 10 Academy, what I understood is to train people in machine learning and data engineering so they can start working for another company. And what I was wondering, and I kind of really feel bad to ask the question, but what I was wondering if what if they might end up working for some company in Europe or Canada or the United States, and not for an African company? So is that a sustainable solution for the people there?
So I think it's a really important question. The short answer is we don't know the answer to it yet. We're working on it and we'll keep looking at it. We view it as follows. So one is that the world of work is changing and it has changed already and it will continue to change. So the skills that we train our young people or our trainees on, they probably have very little to do with what they'll be in terms of the technology stack. What they'll be doing over the next 5 years. So what we're looking for is a way for them to get into work. And that work environment is a continual learning environment. So they need to work so that they can keep learning and they can keep figuring out how the technology fits together. They can keep working on the new pieces of technology that are coming down the line, and they can continue to upgrade their skills. So we think that that is important. The second is we do train our trainees to be useful anywhere in the world. And so what that means is that as they pick up those, the years between 0 and 2 years of experience are extremely difficult. After that, roles open up. We see that a lot of companies in Africa who are looking for data science, machine learning roles, by and large, they don't have the capacity to train fresh graduates. They are looking for people with experience, and they want those people with experience to help design the systems and later on perhaps to bring on some more experienced, some of the more junior people. So our current view is that it is essential for people to get into the world of work. We think that that's part of their training. And because the jobs that they could be doing, whether their companies are based in California or in India or in Brazil or wherever, those jobs will be increasingly similar to the jobs that they would be asked to do if they come back to, to Lagos or to Addis or to wherever you are. We see that transferability is very much there. The third thing that we're seeing, which we find interesting, is that I think there's only 2-3% of our graduates who have physically left their home countries. So people who are working for companies anywhere in the world, by and large, they continue to be based wherever they are physically located.
And it's 98% just like remote work, basically.
Yeah. And so despite them working for companies based wherever they are, I think the fact that they're still physically based wherever they are based, it opens up other opportunities. So we see people who are doing high school training programs. We see a lot of mentoring that's happening. We see a lot of the halo effect, which comes from somebody who's taking up a job doing some really interesting, cool work, and who can explain exactly how technology ABC works to people who are perhaps 1 or 2 years behind them. And they're not necessarily, it's a very different thing. This is one thing that we're learning. If you see somebody who's exactly like you, who knows how to use the most modern cutting edge technologies that you read about on LinkedIn, and that person can explain it to you, and you can fluently switch between your, let's say, Amharic, or between Yoruba and English, because sometimes it's a closer association. But the challenge is, how do we get more entry-level jobs for our trainees on the continent? And that's something that we haven't cracked yet.
So before we dig deeper in it about what your current challenge is, can you probably describe why focusing on data science, data engineering, and machine learning, and, for example, not focusing on other skills like design, app development, or similar stuff like that?
So we've come to this over a couple of years. So what we were looking for are three things, and machine learning engineering and data engineering nicely satisfy these three criteria. So one is, it's really important for us that graduates finish and they can neatly fit into a role that industry is recruiting for. And so what we had in the past is that we graduated people. So one looks back with embarrassment that you did something which was so illogical. So in 2017, we trained people and we said, look, these are smart people. They can do whatever you want. And industry said, okay, but what can they actually do? And we said, whatever you want. And it wasn't a well enough defined topic. So we wanted to make sure that we experimented and we've come closer and closer to what they can do. But machine learning engineering and data engineering are two well-defined careers, and those are well-defined for companies anywhere in the world. And that's important for us because we believe that the first job or the first years of work experience are part of people's training. And so there has to be a neat flow into a career anywhere in the world. So that's criteria number one satisfied. Criteria number two satisfied is that it can be taught within, right now we're looking at a 3-month long training. And this is the challenge with something like data science, because there's, my partner would call this slow knowledge. There's a certain sense or a feeling for how does the experiment work? Are we working towards the good longer term goals? These are not necessarily... These are two topics that we believe we can teach to an industry standard within 3 months. And the third is, we want to move, we see that the future is moving towards what's commonly called the fourth industrial revolution. And these separate differently than, let's say, app design or app development or web development or software engineering, these are rather towards the increasing level of sophistication and complication. And so software engineering is fine, and we think that that's something that can be taught. We are happy to see that there are a number of other programs that are out there which teach those skills, but we want to take some of the most talented people and teach them to do, teach them to pick up this skill. And this is where, if you look at our tagline, where we want to take highly motivated young people and put them into high impact careers, we believe that through, as a machine learning engineer or as a data engineer, an individual person can have greater impact than working as a front end web developer.
Probably a few people I know, designers, I have our UX team currently at the Espas Lab, they might disagree on that one, but this is another discussion. Let's dig deep into one topic. What is machine learning? Can you define that?
So whatever I say, I'm sure I'm wrong in somebody will tell me I'm wrong, and I'm okay with that. But basically, the way I look at it is that machine learning is asking a computer to take in a set of data and based on that data to develop a model for what's likely to happen in the future. So we use techniques like this in our daily lives multiple times per day. So if I'm using Google Maps while driving my car, there's some prediction of how long will it take me to get to wherever I'm going based on where I'm driving, how many other people are driving there, red lights, maybe there's some weather prediction, but traffic prediction while driving. There's some really interesting work that's happening around electricity production based on demand, but also based on weather usage, so that you can scale up or scale down some of the more scalable plants like natural gas plants based on how much electricity is forecast to being used. And we use it while we're using web searching and other many, many different ways per day. So what we're interested in is the fact that machine learning allows one person to combine their software engineering skills with data that's being gathered and to harness this for some useful purpose. So the largest companies that we know, the Googles or the Facebooks or the Amazons, they use this as the backbone of their business. While there are many other companies that use this almost as a additional way to improve the efficiency of their business or to open up new business lines. And so I wanted to give one example, which I found interesting. So there's one of the leaders of the AI revolution, Andrew Ng, I don't know how to say his name correctly. He was one of the people behind Google Brain and then founded Baidu, one of the large Chinese internet companies, their whole AI field. And he invested into this company that I thought was shockingly boring. He's founder or a major investor in a company that guides your telephone sales agents on what to say to increase sales or to improve customer service.
A telephone sales agent.
So you have your human agents, but what they're saying is, why not guide your agents on what they should be saying to help close the sale or to improve customer service? So if we call Deutsche Telekom and complain, and you have an assistant there, which is saying, recommending, look, based on what this person is saying, we've classified this person into this type of person, and they're more likely to respond positively to feeling heard, as opposed to saying, you know, we've logged a complaint in the system and we'll find out what to do next. But it's a use case which is new, which utilizes this machine learning approach, and it adds to what the humans can do. But it's so boring. It's so not interesting, and it doesn't fit with this idea of computers are taking over the world. But this is one of, I thought it was a good example of how AI is being, or machine learning is being integrated into how the world works in many not that fancy ways. But I think that's actually a sign for maturity when you have leaders in the field who are finding ways to earn good money by using technology in ways which integrate into how we live our lives in any case.
What you just described, is this something those people you train as machine learning engineers, is that something they could do after finishing such a 3-month training?
They probably couldn't do it themselves, right? So to give you an example, that would be like asking, could one software developer design a fully functional software system? Eventually they could, but it wouldn't be a very efficient way for one person to do everything. So they could probably play one role on that within a larger team. But what they could absolutely do, and this is a typical use case that we're seeing, is that our graduates come in and they're being asked to maintain and to optimize and to continue the development of systems that are already working.
And this is something they can do.
This is something they can absolutely do. And this is one of the really interesting differences between software and AI systems. So a software system, in theory, you put it up, let's take the example of a website, you put it up and it's running, and by and large, that system should always keep running. But a machine learning system is software plus data, and the data keeps changing. And so what happens, there must always be a human in the loop to make sure that your system is still giving you a reasonable prediction, because the data may change, and that might be because human behavior changes, or it might be that your predictions, the machine is starting to make unusual predictions. So you must always have a human in the loop to maintain, to monitor, to optimize, and to keep improving what the systems are doing. And this is one thing that we actually find really interesting, that there are, we think, more roles to keep the humans in the loop in these AI-driven systems, because it wouldn't be a very good idea to automate everything away. You can't just leave them on cruise control.
I can agree on that. Well, I cannot because I'm not so technical deep in it, but in the last episode or the episode before, I recorded with my CIO, who basically exactly described this effect. He said, we have some kind of a system up and running combined with an artificial intelligence system, but we always will need some kind of human interaction to make sure that this machine we actually have there basically works the way as we humans or we as a company want it to behave or to decide and do things. And that's why there will always be some kind of human interaction and not just on autopilot like a homepage.
Yeah. And I think that's where you need these skilled people who understand the software, who understand the data, but they also need to understand what is the use case.
Okay, let's take this the second one. What is, from your perspective, what is data engineering or data science?
Okay, so I'll answer the data engineering question. So data engineering is a relatively new role. So machine learning or AI models need a lot of data. And what some people would say is that there are enough good models that are out there, and actually most of them probably don't even need to be developed. They exist. You can buy one from, so there are three large providers, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft. You can buy their models, you can use them, you pay for usage. It's there. The challenge is, how do you get the right data to feed those models? And so in terms of the right data, we talk about a reliable supply of high quality and accurate data. And so what data engineers do is
I would add to that because I already talked about my CIO, and P would probably also add as most as possible not biased data.
Yeah, I think that's
but quite challenging.
So for me, maybe I would put that under high quality, but I think and this is where you need the humans as well, because if you're automatically, how do you know that if your data is biased, unless there's a person there to say, wait a minute, all of your data comes from people who are over 1.85 meters. And so maybe our our prediction on how this person will behave when they walk into a store is different because they can see things differently, or it's all people who have no hair or lots of hair. And so I think this is part of the reason why you need that human in the loop. But the reliable supply of high quality and accurate data is one of the big roles that data engineers play. And so I think a big part of it is the collection of that data. So make sure it's timely, relevant, well-structured. And what we're also starting to hear, especially from very large companies, and I assume this affects your company as well, is actually the opposite, where there's so much data already existing in the system and the volume of data that's being collected is so, there's just so much data that how do you get access to the right data to actually do something useful with it? So that's the second part, that's the second career that we're preparing people for. So machine learning engineering is, if we had to summarize it, I would say model building and maintenance, and data engineering is getting the raw materials that serve the models.
So you described that when you have your trainees and when they finish training in machine learning, they can be part of a team to set up such a system, or they can maintain the system. This is something they could do. And what can people do you train for data engineering?
So the data engineers, I think I would say there are two major jobs as far as I can understand. One is helping in building these collection systems, and it could be building a pipeline. Let's say if you are a user on an e-commerce website, the tracking, taking the data from users and putting this into your actual database. So who did you click on? What did you look at? How long did you look at it for? And making sure that the data is collected in a way which your machine learning models actually will use and find useful and cannot be attributed to the right person. And the second is, if there is a prediction or a model or a run that needs to be made, there's a need to create a stable pipeline, and that run could be every day, it could be every week, it could be every hour. It's maintaining that pipeline. And a lot of that is getting that out in a time efficient, but also a compute efficient way.
So when we zoom in now in this training about in 10 Academy, probably just as a quick overview, what's the current numbers of employees who work for 10 Academy?
So we're unfortunately back to a team of volunteers right now. So right now we are myself and my co-founder, a small team of other volunteers. So we do plan to start hiring again early in 2022.
But who will get paid? Do you get paid at all?
We haven't been paid for quite some years now.
Okay, but sorry to ask, but how do you pay the bills?
So we're both doing side jobs. We have regular other jobs that we do. So this is one of the challenges there's always a point, or there's often a point where it's crazy enough. It seems like a great idea, but there's years in between where it seems like a good idea, but maybe it's not a good enough idea. And that sort of validation, or that people who are willing to take a bet on what you're doing, there are not that many people who are willing to do that. So we've been fortunate to have some donors over the years, but it's still very much a volunteer-driven operation.
I have so many questions. Oh, dear. Anyhow, how many students per batch or per year do you have?
So we don't want our batches to go above 50 people per batch. And one of the reasons is our training model.
One batch is 3 months, right?
3 months, yeah. But, excuse me, one of the reasons is we want, what we see is that trainees depend on each other. And we put a lot of emphasis on people learning with each other, sharing progress that they've made, and the entire cohort moving quickly to reach the standard of some of the top people. So when we put out our weekly challenges, we encourage people to share the progress that they've made through daily stand-ups, through tutorials, through question and answers sessions, through discussions. And what we see is that when somebody finds a solution, everyone adopts that solution. And the whole cohort moves quickly, much more quickly ahead than any individual could progress by him or herself. And if we go beyond 50 people, we think that it becomes much more difficult to build those personal relationships where there is some trust. You get to know who is an expert in field A versus field B versus field C. And so our plan is eventually to expand to 500 people per year, or that's our goal. That's the 10 times growth that we're looking for. But we would do that in 10 batches of 50.
So you have professors, you have probably some kind of computers, whatever. How much does a training cost?
So this is, I'd say this is one of the most interesting things that we've been able to figure out. Earlier on, I had said we wanted to get to the point where we could get it down to 1 to 2 months of salary. And that's a hard thing to reach. Global salaries are, by and large, they're set. Entry-level salaries, let's say they're about $1,000 per month, which is generally pretty low, but okay. That's for a remote job, somebody working for anywhere across Africa, $1,000 a month as a fresh graduate, 22, 23 years, that's our target. So we have our cost target, which is we want it to come in at less than $1,000 a month. And the reason is we want to build an initiative which scales by itself. And if you are asking people, if it's too expensive, then only wealthy people can afford it. Or you're locking people into a long-term payback period, which is something that we don't want to do. So we've spent a lot of time innovating around how do you build a scalable and a cheap system. And we think that we're there. So our cost price is less than $1,000 for 3 months of training. And invest that $1,000, and we think that that's 1 month of salary. And so we think that that pay it back is, if you compare it to, we think that's we're very excited about that, because that value for money proposition, we think is pretty hard to beat.
So what are actually the costs?
So our major costs are staff costs and cloud computing costs. So staff costs are we hire tutors. So what we want is that even if people are physically distant, they're not alone. So we have a schedule 5 days a week where we have a team of paid tutors. And if you have a question, we will answer your question. And the tutors are paid to answer those questions. And the feeling is, after the daily stand-up, we want people to be working and we don't want them to be working alone. And the feeling is that if you have someone answering a question within 5 minutes, we use Slack or a Slack-like chat-based system. And that means that things move ahead very quickly because during those hours, our tutors are there to answer questions. So tutors are a big part of the cost. We have some other staff that we need to maintain. And then a large part of the cost are their third-party costs. We need to rent computing space on industry platforms. So we use Amazon Web Services, but Microsoft has one, Google has one. Those computing platforms are unfortunately expensive, but we think that it's essential to invest into... So I think we spent, of the $1,000, I would estimate that about $100 of that are costs that we pay on behalf of the students directly to Amazon, in this case, to rent cloud computing services from them, so that when they go get into their first job, when they go to an interview, they've actually used Amazon Web Services, and they can, we want our people to be productive from day two. So they log on, they know how to use the systems, they're familiar with how everything works, how do you get your access, and how do you use some of these regular computing platforms. So those are our two major costs.
Got it. So let's figure out step by step, hiring people, training people, and getting them in the job. First things first, how do you find and how do you actually recruit these best talents on such a huge continent?
So word of mouth is our strongest recruiter. We're doing no active recruiting, and we're still getting, I think, 3 to 4 people per day who are signing up and waiting for new information about our next cohort. We're getting a number of people per week who are writing to ask, when is our next training taking place? So recruiting people it's not our biggest challenge. There are very few opportunities that are out there, and there are even fewer. There's a big shortage of high quality training opportunities, which are affordable. The other big advantage that we have in terms of recruitment is we're very successful in terms of job placement. And young people are smart, hungry young people are even smarter, and they're looking to optimize their chances of getting a good job. And so word of mouth is our strongest recruiter. We have 2 universities in Africa where we could fill up the entire class just with graduates from one of these 2 universities, where we have enough people who are just interested in applying that we could very easily fill up our class of 50 from one of the 2. But the basic thing that we are looking for is motivation. So we believe that the most motivated people, if you give them the right support, it's not only the best predictor of long-term career success, but it's also a very good predictor of who will do well in our training.
How do you figure out who is highly motivated?
So we give them an incredibly difficult task, and whoever doesn't give up, we consider them to be motivated. And so that's something that we've experimented.
Is that before the training or as part of the training?
Before the training. So we have a 1-week long assessment where we say, the application process is not very long. So in our first application process, we made it very long and very difficult. And we found that the people who made the effort to actually complete the application process, that was a good filter. We've always been trying to figure out how do we scale this. And our current approach is pretty straightforward. Simple application process, a basic test, and then we give people a difficult challenge. And we important is that if you want to finish the challenge and you're willing to invest the 12 to 15 hours per day for 1 week, there is support that's available for you to finish that challenge. Anyone who wants to finish it and is able to put in the hard work over that 1 week long period can finish the challenge. But what we find is that the majority of people aren't, they're not willing to do it. And so actually this is one of our philosophical questions. What are we training for and what are we searching for? And so we've decided to search for motivation and to train for skills that employers are looking for. But we can't we've decided that we don't know how to motivate people, but we know how to find it.
Isn't that kind of mean? To let people work so much time for a week in a kind of hiring or application process. So even before the training, that you have to work, 5 or 6 days a week for 12 or 15 hours a day, just to get part of the badge and become part of the training. Isn't that mean?
So is it mean? No, we take the view that it is, if somebody actually wants to get a job anywhere in the world in this field, unfortunately, this is the expectation. Of course, employers are not looking for that level of expectation. But if they want to get through this course material in 3 months, then they need to bring that level of seriousness to what we're trying to do. So that's number one. And number two is we've never said no to somebody who has completed what we've asked them to complete. So it's always been, we've always had enough open positions. So the way we look at it is we can look at it as mean, if anyone's ever asked the question of, am I doing the right thing? Am I ready for this? We've been ready to provide that support. But I would say that we are trying to set this very demanding level of expectations, but to do so in a human way. To me, it would be very difficult if we were to say, do this or else, or do this or we will withhold whatever it is that we're promising at the end. Because we've flipped things around and we've said, every assignment that you do belongs to you. So this goes to your GitHub code base. This goes to your set of profile. This goes to your profile. You're allowed to show off whatever it is. I feel actually very good about being a difficult and a demanding coach, because we have said to people, this is what you need to do to get to this global standard within 3 months. But is it pleasant? It's sometimes difficult. But because we're also there with them, and if anyone has a question, we're always there during office hours. People can write to us. We attend as many of the stand-ups personally as we're able to attend. I think that I would say it's rather intensive. Is it mean? There may be some mean aspects to it, but I would say it's demanding.
Okay, so you have these people, 50 people per batch. One batch takes 3 months. Tough and demanding process to get in there. And now the training starts. Who are the tutors, the professors? You mentioned that these are volunteers, or do you pay them, or just a part of them? How do you find these professors? Who are they, and how this works?
So I just wanted to take one step back also to this question of recruitment. So one of the reasons why we've designed this is our dream is eventually to get away from the recommendation or the requirement that people have a university degree, because we are convinced that the 8 or 9% of people who go to university in Africa today are not the top 8 or 9%. They're sort of we don't know who they are. They've somehow gotten to university. A lot of it is tied to socioeconomic status. But the one great equalizer is effort. And we think that it doesn't matter what you've done in the past, but if you're willing to put in the work, then we would like effort to be the great equalizer. Because it doesn't matter if you're female, if you're male, if you're rich, or if you're poor. If we create a fair system, then we hope that that effort will be the great equalizer in a scalable way. So that's exciting for us. So eventually we would love to get to the point where anyone who puts the effort in can also get in and not necessarily have to go to university, but they can come to a specific training program and do something really exciting. The training is led by, so we have two different roles. One are our tutors, and those are paid roles. Those are people who tend to have 1 to 2 years of experience, ideally working in industry, working in the machine learning engineering or the data engineering field. And their job is to be close contact with each individual student. They get to know the students. They work with groups of students. They can do specific inputs on topics 1, 2, or 3. And they are very much like teaching assistants in a traditional university. The challenges are designed by volunteers, and we design them either in-house, but in more and more what we're finding are companies are interested in making a contribution by saying, we would like to work with you to design a challenge which is similar to a challenge that we're facing in industry. And there's some really interesting challenges that have come out where my partner, who's he takes care of everything that's related to the technology side, always says, give us your most difficult problem and we'll find a way to put this into a week-long challenge. And so those challenges often come from industry, and they do that on a volunteer basis. And sometimes they're also looking for the ability to hire based on who does really well on these challenges.
Can you give us probably an example? What is this kind of challenge or case you get from some company from somewhere in the world?
So one example one company, an advertising company, said that they want to figure out what is the impact of their advertising on increasing brand awareness. So they had a bunch of data that was provided, and they did what's called an A-B test to find out there are two different ways to serve the ads, and they wanted to decide or to guess which was a more effective way. And so that was one example challenge. Another one was an agricultural company, and they wanted to demonstrate what was the impact of their fertilizer on increasing agricultural yield. And they're a US-based company, and the US government released a bunch of satellite LIDAR data, which was ground mapping data. And they asked our trainees, a really interesting challenge, to programmatically come up with a way to develop a map and a prediction of, so the company wanted to know, was it the fertilizer or was it the ground? And so they wanted the program to say, okay, this is what the growth looked like. Now, this is what, based on what the ground looked like, this is what the difference would look like. And so they had, it's an enormous amount of data. It was the entire United States. And so they needed to be able to do this fast and reliably. The data is all there and it's free. But this is a typical data engineering task. How do you access this data in a fast way and in an accurate way?
What we talked and what I also read is that beside the technical skills during this training, you also pay some time, and it seemed quite a lot of time, and the general employability, let's put it this way. Can you describe a little bit what does that mean, and why do you actually spend quite a lot of time in that?
So what we're seeing, we want to get people ready for the world of work. And the degree of complexity of the roles that our people take up when they join companies is high. And a large part is because work is becoming more interdisciplinary. And when you sit down at your first day of work, it's rare that you will be told exactly what to do. It's much more common that you have to explore what is the current situation, and you need to work with people from other departments, colleagues on your team, with other teams, and to understand what is the problem that they're facing. How do they see the problem that you are being asked to solve? And in many instances, to convince them to work with you to release some of their precious time. So we see communication as essential, teamwork as essential. We see, we put some emphasis, and we want to develop this further. We don't want to create problem solvers, actually. What we're trying to do are to create problem identifiers. So for us, a problem solver is somebody who says, your manager says, this is the problem, go and solve it. What we're trying to create is somebody who can go to their manager and say, if we continue on this pathway in 3 months, we will have a problem. So we should take action now, because I believe that we are going to run into this problem. And so I think one of the most interesting exercises we did was motivated by our trainees, where we had a long discussion, because we would give them challenges and we were not really satisfied with the quality of discussion. And a few of them said to us, and it was a great point, they said, we've never learned how to ask good questions. And so we spent a week working with trainees. How do you ask a good question? What actually makes a good question? And what's the difference between a closed-ended question, which is, how do I do 1, 2, 3, to why are we doing this? And not what are the three things that I should be doing, but what are some of your priorities in delivering this task? And so we spend a lot of emphasis on communication. And part of communication is not just when you do something, not just saying, this is what I did and this is what the algorithm tells me, but rather framing it to answer the question that the business wants to have answered. And also putting some probabilities around that. This is what I think I know. This is why I think I know it. But also, this is what I'm not sure of yet.
I can definitely agree on this question part, because basically every podcast episode is a new challenge to figure out what exactly is the question I want to ask the guest I invited. And it's basically a steady learning process. It's never finished to figure out how to ask a question. Quite challenging.
It is, and it's as somebody who's also, when I hire people, their questions are almost the most illuminative. Because if a person hasn't put the time or the effort into formulating a good question, then they probably haven't understood or they don't care enough to know what I'm thinking about. And so I think that's communication is definitely important. Asking the right questions, problem anticipation is important. Ethics are important. We try and emphasize the point that it doesn't matter. You have to always be honest, and privacy and bias, those are also parts of it as well. But teamwork is one of the biggest challenges that we have. Or one of the topics that we really emphasize. So we force people to work in teams, and they have to get to know people from other parts of the world as well, dealing with remote working environments, dealing with some of the challenges that come up. If somebody is unavailable for one day, what do you do with that person's deliverable? How do you deal with personalities where you have overachievers who haven't learned how to share? Or sometimes you have underachievers or people who lack confidence because they just need a little bit of support or encouragement. We had one really interesting exercise where we assigned team leaders, and we picked all the team leaders were women. And we did that purposely, and it worked out super well because the women formed their own private chat group. And I was also, they invited me to be part of it. And it was amazing to see how much they learned about managing a team, but also how much they outperformed their own expectations, because they realized that they didn't need to be the expert in any one individual field. But what they did need to do was to stay on top of what everyone else was doing and to keep people honest. So we think those career skills are essential. And I think one of the points that we're working on right now is, how do we take all of this and put this into a way which is understandable by a recruiter from anywhere in the world? So what I want is that somebody, doesn't matter if you're in California or if you're in New Delhi, that they see these talented young people and the work that they've done, and they understand these are their capabilities.
I see. So we have a hard and tough process of finding people and recruiting them. Then we have this 3 months of training, where you basically work on a week-to-week basis on your assignment, on the cases, which you get from companies from everywhere of the world. So it's not something the tutors and professors make up, but they really, companies who actually, deal with specific issues, and then you take it. You told that you want to have the toughest jobs which companies struggle with, and this is the one which will be part of the training. So they get it done. They get this 3 months done, learned a lot about fearlessness, learned a lot about identifying problems, and now the next step is getting started. So how exactly does it work that those trainees, when they finish this, then actually get in their first job? How does it work?
So there's no one answer there. I think what we always say, and it's become kind of a joke, is that finding a job is like finding a partner, a romantic partner. And there's no one.
I heard that's true.
And I think it is true, right? Some people use online, some people meet through friends or at a party or on the bus or whatever it is. But there are different ways, and everyone has to find their own way. But what's important, and just like when you're in a relationship, there's certain things, there's certain ways that you can improve your chances. So we provide support, indirect support, in three ways. One is that every single project has been designed to provide a clearly demonstrable output. So what we want is that when trainees finish, they have a set of 10 to 12 different projects that they can walk people through. And they can say, this is what I did. This is the set of slides that I developed. This is the approach that I took. And by the way, here's all the code that I wrote. And you can also walk through the code step by step, line by line. And I can help explain to you why I took approach 1, 2, 3, as opposed to approach X, Y, Z. And we've heard in the past that that has been useful for companies when they are interviewing, that they get an example. So that's built into our training. So we want to make sure that trainees can showcase their skills, not just through a certificate. And because we don't have a name, we're very small, we haven't existed for very long, our name recognition will not open any doors for us yet. So it's really important that we are able to showcase what trainees are able to showcase what they've been able to do. The GitHub contribution is a very important part of that. We have some recruiters who are looking at GitHub as sort of the world's place where everyone stores their code. And so we make sure that everyone, and they have to put their code on GitHub. All submissions are done via GitHub to us. That's where we look at our code. And so that helps trainees to build up a code base. It's actually one of the things, as part of the application process, we force people to open up an account if they don't have one already. And the third is, we spend a lot of time working with trainees to make sure that their quote unquote standard materials, they are immediately accessible to employers. So what does that include? That includes a CV, which is professional, which is error-free, which is clean. But more than anything, it really explains what they're able to deliver from day two. Every trainee has a video, every trainee has a public profile. And our goal is that within skimming that, within 10 to 15 seconds, any employer can get a good sense of who this person is and where they fit in. So this is all sort of the background support that we provide, or you can call it the indirect support. In terms of direct support, we are able to link up companies to trainees and individuals in our networks that are looking to hire. It's a very slow process. We know a number of individuals, not a huge number, but we have at least two companies that have now transitioned their entire technology teams to graduates from 10 Academy. So that those companies, some of
can
those...
You, can you tell which company that is?
So I can tell you where they're based and which fields they're working in. So one is an ad tech company, which is headquartered in London. And so their entire data science team is... they have a huge data science team, which is... They started with one, and then they added three more. Then they added three more, and they've recently hired two, and they plan to keep growing. Fascinatingly, there is that their whole that mindset or that approach is now leading into other parts of the company. The approach that they're bringing, this hunger and this fearlessness, that's great to see. And there's also a Toronto-based AI community, which is they're running based on mostly graduates from our team. And so they had, I think, one volunteer technology leader before, and they've now scaled up to five people.
If you can get probably into the numbers. So how many people already finished this training, and how many of them are today in a job?
So if we exclude the most recent training, because they finished, 5 or 6 weeks ago. So we've placed 20 out of 22 from our 2017 training. Our 2019 training, we were not on the right track, so we stopped that early. So we had one person who finished, and he's placed. Our last year's training, we have 94% placed, which is 33 out of 35. And that's actually higher than we had targeted. And that was a That was a difficult process in many ways because we got a few things wrong in terms of our targeting. It was the first time with this new approach and the new model, but it's really, really good to see the number of people who are out there who are working, in the field, and many in people that we wouldn't necessarily have expected right away. And with our current batch, we're at 15% within 6 weeks. And so that's, I think that's 7 people out of 45.
How much time does it usually take from finishing the training to start the new job?
So companies are really slow. I think that...
I know that.
So I think COVID has actually in some ways slowed things down, and in some ways it's sped things up. It's just gotten, and I'm sure you know this, I know this as well, people are overloaded with information. And, you know, even when we know an individual in a company that wants to hire, what we always tell people is the very, very, very best case is 3 weeks, and you should be ready to wait up to 3 months. Because by the time you go through the formal processes and one interview, second interview, even if you have you've spoken to somebody and they want to bring you on board, by the time you get through your contract and you sort out start dates and laptop and even just getting access, all of that takes a long time. So it does take time.
So we're talking basically about remote jobs. So that means you stay somewhere in Africa working for a company based in London or in Canada or the United States or somewhere else. Aren't there also some kind of legal issues?
Yeah, there are. And so that's something that we definitely have to work around, and we handle that on a company by company basis. So for the majority of companies, there are solutions that can be worked around. Everything has to be done correctly and has to be done legally. So we do help companies through work with partners that help to facilitate that. But that is...
How does the solution look like?
The easiest way is simply to provide a contract. So the person works as a contractor. They're not a full-time employee. And I think in some cases, companies are able to extend an employment relationship overseas. But by and large, they simply become they are on a full-time remote work contract.
I don't know if the question is correct, but... Since we have at Swiss Post, and I guess everybody else, we have quite some discussions about, is remote work well? Is it good for the company, or do we want like to have more on-site time and stuff like that? I don't know if even the question makes sense, but are the people happy to work more or less completely on a remote base?
So what works really well is when they have other colleagues who are similar to them. So if they're sitting completely by themselves in a part of the world where they have no one to talk to, and they are, excuse me, if they're in a different time zone and they're also the most junior person and they might be the only person from that entire part of the world, that's difficult. But when you have other colleagues who are working in a similar field and you have the opportunity to kind of, I don't know, go for lunch every day, and you have your job, but you're physically sitting with other people who are like you, and there are enough co-working spaces where people can get access to that sort of in-person community, those are bridging mechanisms. But I think your question is, I guess there's two ways to look at your question. One is from a company perspective, and the second is from the individual's perspective. From the individual's perspective, I think we always recommend that people try and build a community around them. And we would always try and avoid that anyone is the one person by him or herself in that part of the world. I think that can become difficult. We do have examples where that does happen, and it's in most cases, it's worked out okay. I guess we'll never know about the other side, where would it have been better if they had other input or if they had other colleagues with them. From the company side, I think from the company side, what we're seeing by and large is that companies are happy to get people who are doing the work because they really enjoy doing the work. So if you have we haven't touched on the entire question of diversity, but the field of AI is, per the numbers we've seen, it's 15% women and it's less than 5% people of color. And so our community is 100% people of color, and we are 38% women. And so getting diversity, getting voices who may have come from a different part of the world or may see things differently than you, I think that brings a lot of, there is value in that. And especially around, I think many of the women that we've trained, they end up being among the fastest to get hired. I think because there is this growing recognition that we do need diverse voices. Will remote work be here to stay? I don't know. I don't know exactly how that'll develop. I know that in my lifetime, I've seen how India changed from being, you know, it was almost a joke in the early 2000s that because most Indians were, a lot of people were doing BPO jobs, business process outsourcing. And they said, you know, the good thing about a BPO job is you get paid well, but you can never spend it because you work overnight and you sleep during the day. And so, but it took a decade, but it did transform. And I'm pretty sure that we will start to see this transformation, and then these opportunities will. So I can't predict the future, so I won't say much, but I think that I am happy if I can draw my boundary around high potential young person has a high impact job and they can live with it. And as it's a little bit like the training, as long as we're open and transparent and fair and there are no surprises, people are not being treated poorly, then I'm okay with that.
So let me try to summarize a little bit. So we have the intense hiring process and recruiting process. We have this intense 3 months of training where they learn, those people are you get in these batches, they learn just as some highlights, finding problems, being fearlessness, being on top, keep on learning, finishing this program while doing that, getting your own portfolio code, getting your GitHub profile, setting up your own CV, being as attractive and visible to the outside world as possible. And then afterwards, getting in touch, helping to get in touch with other companies on the one hand, but also it's what I understood is also their own responsibility to make sure that they get hired after that. What I understood is most of it is are remote jobs, and it's quite a philosophical question how the world will look like. What I understood is that in the current batch, which ended a couple of weeks ago, 15% of those who finished the training are in the job. And the last year, I think, was 94%, so quite high. And what also is just an almost a side effect, but I guess for a lot of companies quite important, to get to such a program or such a pipeline that you have people of color, which at least a lot of companies lack with diversity. So getting people of color, getting women, I understood 38% of your alumni are actually women, and to have women in this specific field, having people of black color in this field is something which I guess can make a huge difference to have these people. And also the way you stay in touch is to make sure that those areas where are more alumni, to make sure that they can stay in touch with other, with Telegram groups, that there are some kind of organized communities where you can work together probably, but at least having some kind of lunch or dinner or whatever. And so that this that they don't become the feeling that they are on their own. Just as a really, really, really brief summarize of what you said. And what I would try to do is to take our final lap in this episode. And I have three quick questions for you for the end. First one, which founder fascinates you the most?
So again, I have to read a little bit more about them. But I like the guys at Stripe. So Stripe's a payment processing company. And what I think they really try and understand the foundational questions before they try and solve the questions. So they're really getting deep into some of the core issues that they're solving and building this aspects of quality right from the ground up. So there's a lot more to read and to learn about them.
Second question, since this is last episode for Christmas, what is your Christmas present as an advice for people like me working at a corporate in Switzerland?
I would give you some Belgian chocolate, but that's probably not politically correct for Swiss people.
To be honest, I unfortunately don't even like chocolate at all, so it doesn't really matter for me.
You're going to lose your job. So I think laughter. I think the importance of laughter is really underestimated. And there are many different ways to laugh. And so I think either if it's puns or funny stories of the world, but I wish everyone who's listening, but especially colleagues at the Swiss Post, to take a little bit of time to laugh. Because life, on one hand, can seem extremely serious. But if we take a step back, I think actually all of us are doing super well. And it's easy to get so worried about optimizing for the last 1 to 2% and that we forget to enjoy or to laugh. And it's one thing that I learn from my colleagues in Africa every day. There's always space, no matter how difficult things are, that laughter is always there.
Thank you. At the Espas Lab entrance, we reserved some space for you. Which quote may we note there?
So I'd like to share a quote from the Dalai Lama, where he says that karma means action. So things change by action and not by prayer or by wish. And so I think that's one of the ideas that I like to remind myself of as far as I can. I forget it very often. But the one thing that we can control are the actions that we take. So I would just encourage everyone to take action towards the goals that they want to reach.
Karma means action. So things change by action, not by prayer, not by wish. Arun, thank you very much and Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.